This is an absolute passion of mine. My brother is a pastor. My father-in-law is a church planner, worked with church planners in India. My father planted churches. Talking with pastors is very near and dear to my heart. And I used to think I wanted to be one until I got into this job and saw how hard it is. And so I've decided to just sit at my desk and offer advice for a small fee. And so I will let you guys do the hard work. And if you have any questions, give me a call. It's interesting because here in the United States, we're forced to put the church in context of legal entities with members and rules and bylaws and constitutions and corporate, you know, all those sorts of things. And in the Bible, we get very little church governance advice except from who qualifications. We get that if somebody's missing, you need to fill a board spot, you cast lots. And so far, I haven't had anybody offer that. I don't have any clients that do that to fill board spots. I've recommended it to many of my clients, and none of them have taken them up on it. So it is something that a lot of people argue about. And if you say, John, what's the best governance? What's the best way to set up a church? I can show you 10 different churches, over 20,000 members that all have different governance models and different styles. I will tell you the key to any of those is communication and a heart for the people that are coming to hear the Word of God every week. And therein lies a lot of the problem. The risk with church business now is the people that are coming to hear the Word of God, that you're trying to attract in to hear the Word of God. And one of the reasons it can become a problem is because under our state laws, all 50 states have laws about religious nonprofits, is they have this idea of members. And believe it or not, the folks in your church may have a lot of legal rights, and that's a scary thing for a pastor, who I'll get to later under the First Amendment, has no employment rights whatsoever. And so you're looking at a group of individuals who may know or may not know that they have a set of statutory rights as a member of your church. And whether you have members or not is buried in your articles of incorporation and bylaws. And so I'd really encourage you on a practical note, when you go home, get out your articles of incorporation, your certificate of formation if you're in Texas, get out your bylaws and read them. If you start seeing things about members and voting rights and rights to records and requests and financial information and budget, you need to start thinking seriously about that, because one of these days, if you haven't had already, someone is going to come to you searching for some information. And you may not be aware that they have a legal right to that information. And in some states, if you don't give it to them, it's criminal misconduct. It's like a Class B misdemeanor. So this is something you really need to educate yourself on. And I'll talk a little bit about the bathroom issue and how you handle that, some different areas. But I really just want to kind of encourage you, go back, look at those governing documents. Nobody went to the mountain to get those, so they can change. So don't worry about that. You know, hey, we need to amend the bylaws. And somebody says, well, we can't do that. They were handed down to us by our forefathers in 1923. You know, the forefathers didn't go to the mountain either. So that can be changed very, very regular. Like I said, unless we all want to get back to casting lots, I don't see any requirements for this sort of thing. So let me tell you a little bit about members and how it works. And maybe this will kind of shed some light on the bathroom issue and counseling issue and how you handle our cultural issues of today. So in state law, you get to create a nonprofit corporation, which most churches are. They're a nonprofit corporation. And then you get to choose members or no members. Well, if you grew up in a church, you can't have a church without members. So most people choose members. But that doesn't mean what we think it means. Think of it as a co-op or a homeowners association that has members who get to vote on issues. That's what the state law is talking about when they say members. So if you're thinking accept Jesus and get baptized, that's not what the courts are thinking. The courts are thinking somebody who's got a legal stake in the decisions that are made with that organization. And sometimes that's good. Sometimes folks want, you know, hey, we want people to vote on a budget and be supportive. We got a building project. We want to know that people are supporting this before we go through with it. So you can draw lines and say, hey, members are going to vote on this and they're going to vote on that, but they're not going to have these decisions. They're not going to make these overarching governance decisions or budgetary decisions. So if you've got questions about, contact a lawyer and they can help you kind of dive into those different areas that you can work with. And herein lies the issue with transgender, same-sex marriage, and those sorts of things, is that when you have someone who has a legal stake in your organization, then what they say carries weight. And you need to be able to effectuate change in response, never reaction, but response to the culture around you, and be able to defend that and lead your members down a road that they'll understand where you're coming from. So that's really what I want you to do. Your homework is go back, read those governing documents, and just figure out, do you have members? Do they have legal rights? Because that's gonna change how you respond to changing the bylaws, how you create policies about same-sex marriage and transgender issues. Who's at stake? If someone's saying, hey, I'm being removed from the church and I'm a legal member here, then you better be following the processes in your bylaws for removing that member. And that's really what I want to bring up in my first point. We talked a little bit about the panel, about discipline. I think we would all agree that that's something that's biblical. Matthew 18 is obviously our key verse for that. Some of you may have exercised that. Some of you may have never even seen what biblical discipline looks like. It's a difficult process. It's emotional. There's personalities. There's families involved and things like that. It's not a fun process to go through, but it is necessary. I had a church call me and ask me. They said, hey, you know, we're a conservative church, but we don't do this whole discipline thing. We never will. We don't get involved in our members' personal lives like that. If there's an issue, we just talk to them. We want you to remove the discipline process from our bylaws. We don't want to have a member discipline. I said, guys, I really, really think that we need to keep it in there. You never know what's going to come up, you know. And I can give you the really two examples that continually comes up in churches is when there's someone who's having serial affairs in the church, and then business scams, where someone's scamming a lot of the members. So those are situations where you have to address at some level publicly what's going on to kind of give people a heads up. And so they said, hey, we don't want to have this in here. It's just a distraction. We're not interested in it. If people are getting worried about it, that we're going to start getting them for gluttony and laziness, and which is always an issue. Sorry to bring that up off the pie. But take it out. And I said, guys, all right, well, if that's what you want to do, we don't recommend it, but we'll take it out. So we took it out. They called me 2 weeks later. I was like, wait a month, just 1 month. And they had a couple in there that was running a swingers club and in the church and drugging the kids so they would go to sleep at night. I mean, it was a disaster of a situation, one that absolutely had to be addressed. And they had just stripped their bylaws of all the disciplinary processes. So it's something that you need to take seriously. And don't think, we'll never use it. We haven't used it in years. We'll just deal with it privately. And the reason why is because if you exercise discipline and say something publicly, and by publicly, I mean to one other person, and it's not true or it's not exactly, the details aren't exactly correct, you can be sued for defamation. And there are courts that will say all over the nation, if they are a church member and they have put themselves under the church membership discipline by joining the church, it's in the bylaws, then it's a church internal matter. We're not going to worry about it. The church can do what they want. But if you can't show that they are a member or that you had a discipline policy, then the courts will hold the church liable for defamation over and over and over again throughout all 50 states. So this is a very, very serious issue for members. When it comes to employees, we're seeing this come up more and more with employees and their issues regarding marriage and sexuality, or, oh, my living girlfriend, actually, she's my common law wife. Sorry, I didn't tell you. Things like that that we're running into that churches aren't sure how to deal with. And I want to talk to you a little bit about how to work with your employees to ensure that you're in a good standing from a legal standpoint, because employees, they know their rights. You may not know, but they know their rights. And unlike members who don't really know what a corporate member of a nonprofit is, employees do. They know what their rights are. So I want you to think of the life cycle of the employee. They're going to be there, they're going to start, and then one day they're going to leave. And you need to think about all of the in-between. They may die, they may retire, you may fire them, but they're going to leave at some point. When someone comes to the church, you need to make sure that they understand under no certain terms that this is a Christian organization, that you have a statement of faith that they are expected to abide by. I cannot tell you the countless churches that that we've worked with that have hired non-ministerial staff, and I'm talking about non-ministerial staff here because, like I said, minister staff, they have no legal rights, they just don't. Non-ministerial staff, they need to understand that you're going to hold them to an expectation. Because if they get fired for not going to church or doing something they shouldn't do or not holding up an example that is worthy of the church's beliefs or influence of the community, and you get rid of them, there are a lot of churches that have been sued or fined by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for discriminating against that employee's belief. So don't take these things lightly. And especially when it comes to our changing culture around sexuality, this is a difficult topic. And you're going to see this battle more at a local level, not a national level. You're going to see it from a county and state level, where you have municipalities and counties and states saying, hey, people need to be able to use whatever bathroom they want to use. You shouldn't have those restrictions, and we're not going to allow you to operate, or we're going to fine you if you don't allow that. And so this is something you need to be in tune. I can tell you most of the cities where this has become law, especially in the South and the East, where there's a higher Christian population, the Christian population is not involved in their city at all. We're seeing very, very low turnouts for Christians and for church attendees. And they're not voting for city council members, and then these city council members will vote in these laws that are putting the church in harm's way. And we don't know yet what the legal landscape is going to unfold, whether we're going to be forced to do something or not. But I will tell you this, now is the time to meet with your board, your elders, and hear God, and hear what he's saying to you about how to respond. And then call a law firm who's willing to put into place boundaries and policies and procedures that help protect the call and the word of God that he's given you. It's very, very important. I can give you legal advice all day long on how to stay out of legal trouble, but you're never going to be trouble for the enemy if you don't listen to the voice of God. And so I just really want to encourage you in all of these things, whether it's employees or it's members, listen to the voice of God, because there may come a day when the news media is tapping on your door and saying, hey, you did this, it's very unpopular, people think you're bigots, what's your response? And you need to know that you're in good company of people who have been accused of very bad things in the name of the gospel. And so I just encourage you, take a look at those documents and take a look at what you feel like the Lord's calling you to do in those responses to a culture. Is it the bathrooms? Is that where you draw the line? I don't know. It's not a legal question right now. We don't know what the law is going to say. Where do you draw the line? When it comes to counseling and counseling these sorts of things, I will tell you, I would really encourage you to connect with some Christian licensed counselors. This is a tough, tough topic. And pastoral counseling is an amazing tool. It's helped thousands of people. I'm sure the pastoral counselors represented in this room over the years have helped an innumerable amount of people. But I will tell you, there are limits and there are risks to the mental issues that surround transgender issues. And so I would tell you, you need to connect with a licensed counselor for sure. When it comes to all these other issues, you know, we've talked about a statement of faith for your views on sexuality and marriage. That's very important because that lays the baseline. It lets everybody know this was not arbitrary and capricious. We made a decision. This is our sincerely held belief. And then as you begin to build policies around employment and membership and your statement of faith and volunteers, it begins to put people on notice. But I will tell you, lawsuits are most avoided in the response that the church gives to the individual. And a lot of times we'll see churches when someone calls up and say, hey, we're a same-sex couple and we want to use your church for a wedding. If the receptionist can respond in love, saying, thank you so much for calling us, I'll tell you what, here's a copy of our marriage policy. Here's a copy of our statement of beliefs. Please look at it. Please note that the marriages we will and will not perform, or our pastors will or will not perform. But if you have any questions, or there's anything we can do for you, or you'd like to come to church on Sunday, please let me know. Most of the time, the issue just goes away because you're not the ideal defendant. Even if it's an activist situation, you're not the ones that they're wanting to haul in front of court and say, listen to this recording. She was so nice to me. So just remember to respond in love with those issues, but stand firm. My father always charged us boys growing up with 1 Corinthians 16, 13, and 14. Stand firm in the faith. Act like a man and be strong. But everything you do, do it in love. And that is so key to dealing with these cultural issues right now. Stand firm, act like a man, and be strong, and do everything in love. And so I would just encourage you to can you do that? I know there's a lot of legal questions out there. It may not be on this. I didn't hit all of the details on this. I'd certainly be happy to give them to you. But I just have a feeling there's probably a lot of questions, and your answers are going to come from those. So Dr. Evans, is okay. I'll take a Q&A.
You mentioned the wording of members. Would partners be something that would cover, you know, like when you ask, you know, we generally ask for members, but I've started asking for partners to join in. Is that a safe word? I mean, to as opposed to members?
Yeah, this is the favorite lawyer answer. It depends. the key to whether your church has members is going to lie in your corporate documents, and you're going to have a line in your articles that either mentions members or it's going to say there are no legal members. If there's nothing in your articles of incorporation, then you got to look to your bylaws. What do your bylaws say? And if you use a word like partners or covenant members or something, they're like, well, it doesn't say legal members. You need to go ahead and have a line in there. We do not have legal members. You need to make it clear. This is not a time to be ambiguous, but flowery language. It's a time to be clear, because the bylaws, as much as they're for your internal cultural use, it's also something that a judge who may have never been to church in his entire life is going to look at one day, and you need to make sure they understand it.
Quick question. You spoke a lot about the members' rights. Does the church have the right to hold members legally responsible for established debt that they voted on?
That's a good question. Generally, the answer is no. And that's why the churches incorporate, is to protect members and directors from those sorts of things. If it was done fraudulently, or there was some other extenuating circumstance where misconduct was seen in it, then they could be held liable. But generally, you incorporate, you have a nonprofit corporation to protect the directors, the elders, and the members from those sorts of things. And so if you are voting on debt, it's a reasonable decision, the banks approved it, everything's above board, and no one's acting fraudulently, no one's acting with misconduct, then generally no one's going to be held liable for that personally. And if you have a bank that's coming back and say, hey, we're going to go after your members now, that's a problem, and you need to contact a lawyer.
How you doing, sir? Thank you. There's an influx of sexual offenders in society now. And what would you recommend when those who have a sexual offense record want to join the clergy and they have a call and they want to be licensed and ordained? And I know that's a broad question, but if you can give me any input on that.
Absolutely. That's a great question. What do we do with folks who have a particularly violent or difficult criminal history when they want to be involved in the church at any level? And we're full. Our churches are full of folks who have been redeemed. So I'm going to speak from the legal standpoint and not the spiritual pastoral standpoint. So please hear what I'm saying from a strictly legal liability standpoint. When you have someone who comes into your church and they have sexual offenses in the past, you have to handle it very, very carefully. And what I mean by that is the law sees them as dynamite, and they say handle with care. They can't be left unattended in any way. And so if you have someone who is coming on staff and they have a past of sexual crimes, they need to be put in a position where they are not around children, particularly, and there are safeguards put around them for all sorts of reasons. But from a legal standpoint, they can never be around children alone. We really actually would even say they can't be around children at all. They're not allowed to work with children at all. They're not allowed to be around children. That's a very difficult standard, I know. But from a pastoral standpoint, they need to be in a position where they're safe, where no one can wrongly accuse them of something. And because if they're accused of something, it's going to be bad on the church. It's going to be bad on them. There's no way. There's a no-win situation out of that. No win. Nobody's going to win out of that. So you really need to take every situation with that person and say, okay, what are they going to do for the church? How are they going to be separated from the vulnerable individuals in our church? And what are we wanting to do with them? But if you just have a member coming, we do have what we call accountability agreements for members, and a lot of attorneys can help you write them. But basically saying, you're not alone. You're not going to be alone. You're not allowed in the children's area. You've got to go through this group, Celebrate Recovery, or be a part of a life group or a cell group, whatever you call them. And there's certain things that they can and can't do, and you're going to keep an eye on them at all time. That can be burdensome. Particularly in big cities like Dallas or Fort Worth or Houston, you know, where maybe you have a lot of population in a small pocket. But what we're seeing is when you offer that protection for them, you have a lot more people who are willing to raise their hand and say, you know what, I've got a tough past. And if you're willing to help me, if you're willing to let me be a member of this church, then I want to sign up for that. I want to be a part of that accountability group rather than just hiding it and nobody knowing.
Yeah, I have a question. Now sometimes in some of our congregations, we have auxiliaries that end up trying to raise funds, and they use the terminology raffling. We're being told that is a no-no anymore.
So the state gambling laws govern raffles for nonprofits, and a lot of state laws will actually have a limit on the number of raffles that churches can have or any nonprofit can have. My father-in-law started and runs a missions organization, and they have fundraisers every year, and this is a difficult issue, always trying to tell the staff, no, you can't do too many raffles or not. I generally just try to stay out of it and tell them to go find legal counsel somewhere else. But, yeah, it is an issue. Raffling is an issue. It's considered gambling under state laws, and so you need to meet with somebody, an attorney in your state, if you do have those, and ask their opinion on it. But it can be an issue. I will tell you, certainly there's not churches and pastors going to jail every day for raffles they have. But we don't do things because we don't get caught. You know, that's not the idea. But I would tell you, you need to talk to an attorney about that because it is gambling. It is covered under gambling laws.
Just have a kind of a two-point question, but our church is incorporated, but we're not 501c3. And I was thinking, because 501c3 has some different rules you fall under, and we still, as far as I thought the government's concerned, we're still protected in terms of being incorporated. Number two, on the membership thing, when we see a person on a membership basis on their confession of faith in Christ, that's kind of our criteria. We give a copy of our Constitution bylaws, and in that we have incorporated how you could be removed from your membership and an appeal process. And if they agree to that, is that, are we kind of protected of that in that sense, as long as we have given them something that, and they have the criteria by which they could lose a membership and appeal that within our own structure? Is that?
I'll answer the second part first. If you have a membership discipline process, you need to make it available to your members somehow. Doesn't mean that you need to talk about it every Sunday. It just needs, they need to understand that there is a discipline process, and they can look up that process and read about that process at any time. Doesn't mean they have to. It just means it's available to them. The first question I get all the time, almost every day, from churches, and that's we're a church, but we're not a 501c3. The 501c3 is a section of the Internal Revenue Code that says if you're a type of organization that does religious, charitable, educational work, then you fall under this section. There's another section that says these organizations have to apply for a 501c3 designation. Churches don't have to apply. So if I incorporate a church in the state of Texas or the state of New York or the state of Alaska or wherever, and I'm holding services and we're a church, I'm a 501c3 organization. I do not have to apply for that. Whereas a charity, you know, if someone's out here, you know, United Way or wherever, they have to apply to be a 501c3 organization. The nice thing about applying is you get that letter from the IRS that says, we are a tax-exempt organization. You don't get that if you don't apply, but you don't need it. Most churches in America have actually not applied for the 501c3 status. So you're in good company if you haven't done that. People can still give. They can still deduct it from their taxes. So that's not an issue as of right now. I'm not saying that'll always be the case. There's a big press to have churches have to file 990s, report pastors' compensation. And that's one thing I want to say about members' rights that I had on here, and I got distracted, and I'm sorry, is under most state laws, those books and records requests, you know, that I mentioned, say, hey, we want to see the finances of the church. What are they after? What do they want to know? They want to know what the senior pastor makes every time. It boggles my mind. They don't want to know how much you spend on batteries. They don't want to know how much the crackers and the kids, you know, ministry. They want to know what does the senior pastor make. And they're fine with that as long as it's less than what they make. It's just the way it is. You don't ever have to release that. There is no case law anywhere that says the senior pastor must release his private compensation to the congregation. So if you have somebody and they're claiming, well, you got to release your books and records, and we're talking about audited financial statements, general stuff. We're not talking about who gets paid what. And if they really press, then I think you just need to offer to come to their work, see how much they pay, and then mash it up to their tithing records, and you'll call it even. So, anyway, any other questions?
All right, a couple of things real quickly. First of all, in general, we were faced a lawsuit for our disciplinary action, and the courts found we did everything according to our bylaws. However, it caused harm to them, and while we didn't have to pay anything because we went to appeal, but they did charge us like $350,000 to them for the harm that was done, even though we did everything right. And we ended up, you know, we went to the Court of Appeals, and then they kind of dropped it before. We're in Missouri, so we felt pretty confident in the...
Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask is what state are you in? Because the defamation laws for churches and disciplinary action are different in different states. You absolutely have to have a process to have a chance of winning that case. And obviously, I don't know all the facts of what went on there. But in many cases, if there is actual harm, specifically financial harm to that individual or reputational harm, then a church can be held liable for defamation. And that's why the discipline process is so important. We don't want to be giving up our ability to discipline members simply because there's this threat out there. But if you, here's the rules for defamation. Here's how you get sued for defamation. Something is said publicly. It's either false, or if they're a public individual, it was done with malice or reckless disregard, meaning it would have been easy to find out the truth, but you didn't bother. And then you say it publicly, and it causes harm to that individual. And that's how you get sued for defamation.
In our case, we won defamation. They literally said you didn't do anything wrong. You did everything according to your books. And it also caused harm. And so that's the reason why we think they dropped it before it went to appeal. Here's a couple of things I wanted to ask you real quickly. One of them is there a transfer of liability when boundaries are removed by the state or the legislature? Like, for example, if they did say, I have to let this guy go in the bathroom with our little girls, then, and something happens, then is there a transfer of liability, or am I liable for whatever happened because I follow the law? Yeah. That's the one question. The second question is, I know you guys put out general information that helps churches understand how to incorporate these kinds of things. And I want to know if you have kind of an archive of things that we, and I know this kind of impinges on your financial, your ability to charge, but if there's kind of an archive of general information that's out there that people can get a hold of, and like the membership thing and things of that nature.
We actually have We have a ton of resources out there free of charge. If you'll just contact us and ask to talk to me, John Anthony, I can help you with that. I've got guidebooks and white papers and forms and other things. So feel free to give me a call if you guys got questions. I don't mind talking to you through whatever you've got going on. And if it gets it's too hairy and we gotta you got to retain us for some legal reason, then we can talk about that. But I've got a lot of information that hopefully I can give you. Regarding is there liability if the government says we have to do something and we do it and then something happens. The way churches get sued if something happens is generally through a legal doctrine called negligence, meaning you had a duty to do something and you failed to do that and harm was caused because of it. That's kind of the 50 cent version. So if you have someone, so let's say worst case scenario, state law comes down and says you have to allow men to use the women's restroom. You have to. And I walk into your church. I won't use me. That's a bad example. somebody else walks into your church. And they're a man. And they walk into the women's restroom off the street. They just walk into the women's restroom, and they do something to somebody. They hurt somebody. Are you liable? The question hinges on, did you do what a reasonable church would do to protect its members and attendees? And so the jury is going to look at, well, you had a security guard at the door, and you had security cameras around. You didn't have them in the bathrooms because that's an invasion of privacy. But, it was in an open space. You know, you could walk freely into the bathrooms like out here. It wasn't tucked away in some corner where nobody could see or nobody could go. And then a jury is going to look at all these factors and say, you know what, bad things happen to good people, and the church was reasonable in the way they handled that situation. There was nothing more they could have done. Or they're going to say the church was unreasonable. They knew that there was a high level of predators in the area. They didn't have any security guards. They didn't have any type of verification system. The kids didn't have their own bathroom. They knew there was a risk. So they're going to look and see all these factors. And so if you see something in your church and go, you know what, that could be a problem. You know what, we need to make a note of that. You need to do something about it. You need to talk to a lawyer or talk to your staff, because the standard is going to be, were you negligent? You knew there was a risk, so how did you respond? The law does not require you to be perfect. You can't be perfect. Bad things are going to happen. It's just the way it is. But you do have to be reasonable, and that's the standard. That's how you keep out of trouble.
Hi, just a quick question. There's a lot of misconceptions in regards to churches having to file taxes or not. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just say this, because I'm dealing with this a lot this week. You have to pay payroll taxes. I hope you understand that. You can be held personally liable and criminally liable for withholding payroll taxes from the government. So if you've got employees, W-2s, and there's payroll taxes going on and the budget's short, that is not the place to skip. Let the lights go out. I'm just telling you. Somebody will donate for the lights. It's real hard to donate to your legal fees to get you out of jail. So payroll taxes, you absolutely have to pay. There's this question on income tax and 501c3s and all these kind of deals. Generally, on a charitable organization, if they have income coming in, you know, donations, tithes, offerings, things like that, they're not having to pay taxes on any of that. I have had pastors absolutely scared to death call me and say, John, we've got $300,000 in the bank and we got nowhere to spend it, and I don't know what the government's going to tax us on it, and I don't know what to do. And that's not going to happen. If you got $300,000 in the bank, you don't know what to do with it, you need to hire me. I'll tell you what to do with it. I'm serious. You got another issue there. So don't worry about making money, meaning you have more than your budget. You need to praise God for that, and it's okay. You don't have to pay taxes on it. There are certain activities you do have to pay taxes on, and that's what the government calls unrelated business income taxes. So if you're doing something that's not a charitable work, you know, the organization, the church, like, okay, we got this. We bought a gas station. We bought a dry cleaners. And it's just, we don't know what to do with it. Somebody just donated it to us, and it's generating money. Then you need to talk to a CPA. Sometimes you'll be taxed on it. Sometimes you won't. There's really strict rules when it comes to leasing property. Is there debt on it? Is there not debt on it? And so it's really those outside activities that don't have to do with the activities of the church, the charitable organization, that you need to talk to a CPA and talk about taxes. But just as far as the income of the church, if it's just normal income, you have over and above your expenses, don't worry about that. But you should. Every church should have somebody they work with, a CPA. I really, really encourage that. Just think, don't think, well, we don't do taxes, so we don't need a CPA. You do, and they can help you through a lot of these sorts of issues.
We have started a Hispanic arm of our church. They have a, they have their own pastors and everything, but from a liability standpoint, should we set them up as a separate LLC?
No, that's a good question. We get that a lot, especially with the development of more and more multi-sites. You know, should they be their own entity? Should they be there under the church? The issue all comes down to control. Do you want to control it or not? If you want to control it, if you want to have an influence, as to, not just an influence, but control as to what's going on, then they need to be under your organization. Because if you have a lot of folks on their board anyway, you make up the majority of their board, you're not really limiting that liability anyway. The best way to limit liability is actually through insurance. That's really the best way to protect yourself, because that's what a court's going to look at anyway with those separate organizations. They'll say, are they adequately insured? Okay, then we'll keep the liability over there. But if you want to control something and you want to have a lot of influence into it and it's going to be your own, you need to keep that underneath the church as a single entity. But unfortunately, that opinion is about as varied as what color shirt looks best. You're going to get an attorney with a different opinion on everything. But that's generally what we advise.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.